Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us for the second hour of the show. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the program. Kyle Mabry is at the controls for this hour. In this hour of the show, I am very pleased to have the opportunity to talk with Josefina Lopez. She's a playwright, screenwriter, author, performer. A lot of people will know her for her play and film, Real Women Have Curves. She has also written for television and for cable networks. She's written feature-length film scripts for some big studios, Warner Brothers, New Line, Castle Rock. So she's written many plays and screenplays. She has authored a novel that was published in 2009, a novel titled Hungry Woman in Paris. And she is here visiting campus, spending some time as artist in residence. The Department of Latino Studies is hosting her here. She's been spending a lot of time talking with students about writing and doing creative work, and we're very happy that she could be here and spend some time with us. People can call in if you'd like to talk with her, 333-9455, and toll free 800-222-9455, or email as possible as well, and that's will-talk@illinois.edu. And also, I will mention a little bit later that she's going to be giving a talk and doing a book signing tomorrow on the campus, so if you'd like to meet her and hear more from her, you can attend. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. So what I read about you suggests that you, from the point that you were pretty young, you were a storyteller.
Yes.
Something comes really natural. Maybe it's in your DNA.
I think so. You know, I tell people that my first writing teacher was my mother. And she was a really great storyteller. But because my mother didn't have an opportunity to get an education, all she did was tell chisme. Chisme is the word for gossip. So some of our best storytellers are actually in beauty salons telling their stories. They're doing it as oral literature. So, yes, my grandfather and my mother would tell a lot. I mean, I have so many storytellers, and a lot of the stories that they would share would be ghost stories. Of course, the story of La Llorona, the legend of the crying woman, and all kinds of other ghostly encounters and things like that. And you know, all kinds of gossip and things that happen around town and in the barrio and things like that.
Yeah. Well, was it the experience with storytelling that way and the impulse to tell stories that way, was that what got you interested in doing theater?
Theater, you know, I think being Latina and Latino, we're very dramatic people, so it comes very naturally to us. I also think the fact that we have telenovelas, like you know, if you've ever like passed through the channel and saw a telenovela, we're just very dramatic people because we really... One of the things that I love about being Latina is that we are really in the moment. Like, everything is so, like, oh, you know, magnified. And then on top of that, I have ADD, which means that, like, I get bored very easily. So things have to be really interesting for me to, like, get involved or get interested or pay attention. So I think all that automatically makes me a playwright because that's the place where I belong.
Well, and also when you were younger, but you've also done some acting as
yes,
well.
Yes, yes. You know, the other thing, too, is when I was in ninth grade, I saw a beautiful, it was a TV show. It was weird because I was studying French and we had a French teacher who was married to a Mexican woman. And he really wanted to empower us. So he would be teaching us Chicano studies under the guise of French. And so I still can't speak French to save my life, but I know a lot about Chicano studies. So he showed us a TV special by Luis Valdez called La Carpa de los Rascuachi. It's hard to translate, but it's like the tent. It's really hard to translate. The tent of the Rascuachi. And Rascuachi means like by any means necessary, doing something cheap but getting it done. And I remember seeing the show, and for the first time in my life, and I was like 14, 15, I had seen a story that was about being an immigrant. And like everything on television until up to that point, like basically told me that Latinos did not exist. We really were aliens from another planet and that nobody knew we were on this planet. But on television, nothing. So seeing this show made me go, oh my God, who is Luis Valdez? And he's a playwright. Wow, playwright. What does that mean? Like you can write plays for the stage, but it's on TV. And that was the beginning of me thinking, wow, maybe I could be a playwright and tell stories about my life because maybe my life... My experience as an immigrant, as an undocumented person, is important.
Yeah. So you were born in Mexico, but when you were a little girl, your family came to the United States.
When I was 5 years old, my parents brought me to the U.S.
Yes. And so you did really your growing up in most in Los Angeles?
Yes, in Boyle Heights, which is a predominantly Mexican neighborhood. It used to be a Jewish neighborhood, a Japanese neighborhood, eventually became Mexican neighborhood, and that's where I grew up.
Yeah. So, and until you were an undocumented person?
Until I was 18.
You're 18?
Yes. So I came to this country just like a lot of young people are brought here by their parents not knowing that they're undocumented. Until one day their parents tell them, don't tell anyone you don't have papers. And you're like, toilet paper? What? What kind of papers are we talking about? And they explain to you that you don't have papers, that we're not supposed to be in this country. And then you start thinking, oh, my God, you mean I could be deported? I could be separated? It becomes very traumatic, and you internalize your invisibility. So I tell people, like, the word alien is really painful because it really, as a young person, when they refer to people as aliens, you're like, I'm not human. That's what and it really, it's painful. And, you know, So it wasn't until the amnesty law was passed in 1987 that I was able to qualify and apply. And right after high school, I couldn't go to college. And so I had to work in a sewing factory. And then I was able to qualify and go off to New York University.
So I think that probably people will know you for Real Women Have Curves. Many, many people have seen the film that was made of that play, and then that the play has been performed
over 50, 60 productions of it throughout the country.
And if people will remember this, this is, and maybe if they know the film, that the play just takes place in the sewing factory.
Yes.
The film, because it's a movie, has to make a little bit bigger story.
So
but
it has
essentially
to be a different, yeah.
So they know that it's the story of a young girl who wants to go to college and also has these struggles about her connections with her family, particularly with her mom, and you know, who it is she wants to be, and things about, you know, women and what their role is, and what's the, you know, what does it mean to be a woman, and what does it mean to be beautiful, and all this kind of stuff. And you wrote this when you were just 18 years old?
I started writing it at 18. At 19, I wrote the first draft. And then around 21, it got produced in San Francisco.
So this, I think I saw an interview where you said something like, what you did when in writing this play was try to take all of the things that you personally were struggling with, all of the things that maybe people had told you were wrong with you, and
yes,
you put them in that play.
Well, you know, how it really started, and I've told this story a million times, and I'll tell it again because I haven't told it on your station, is I was at the High School for the Arts, at Los Angeles County High School for the Arts. I was studying theater, and it had always been my dream to be an actress, but I was always afraid to tell people that because I was overweight and being Mexican. And my fear was like, oh, you can't because only white people can be, you know, actors, because that's all you've seen. That was all that was possible. So I remember one of my best friends, like, she wasn't very good looking either. And she said, oh, yeah, I'm going to be an actress. And I looked at her and I said, well, I can be one too, you know. So I had the courage to audition for the High School for the Arts. And I got in and I studied theater. And my second year, my final year, my senior year, we were doing Chorus Line. And everyone had to wear leotards to do the scene with, I got, you know, I hope I get it and all that. And I couldn't put on a leotard because I didn't feel comfortable with my body. And so I was wearing shorts. So the teacher pulled me aside. And the teacher was really a wonderful teacher, Mrs. Stoddard. And she took me aside and she said, why aren't you wearing a leotard? And I told her, it's because I feel embarrassed. I don't want people to see my body. Da, 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 da. So she wanted to make sure. She knew I was undocumented. I had confided in her. And she said, okay, I just wanted to make sure it wasn't because you didn't have the money, because I would give you the money if you needed the money. And I was like, no, I can ask my parents, but... And then she pulled me aside and she said, you know, let's walk down the hallway. And she said, you know, I really believe in you. And the dance teacher and I were talking about how wonderful an actress you are, and that you have the range to play Lady Macbeth and Juliet, that you really are a wonderful actress. But unless you lose weight, no one's going to give you the chance to play Juliet. You'll never get to play the lead. You'll never get to be the ingenue. And it's unfortunate, but that's the way it is. All the skinny women get the best parts, all the fat women, they get to play character. They're character actresses, and that's the way it is. And I was like, oh, and it was so painful because I always was afraid that someone was going to tell me I was too fat to be an actress. And here she was telling me, but coming from the right place, telling me the truth. And I remember crying and trying to lose weight. Like, for the first 2 months, I tried to lose weight. And at some point, something inside of me said, man, you know, I'm overweight, I'm poor, I'm undocumented. At that time, I didn't know I was actually also suffering from depression and suffering from ADD and dyslexia. I was like, man, I'm the perfect minority. All I need to be is a lesbian, a handicapped lesbian, and then I'll be like, you know, like every strike against me. Like, part of me was like, well, I should just give up. You know, really, what chance do I have? I should just go be a statistic. I should just go get knocked up and be one of the girls that gets stuck in the barrio and just collects welfare. Like, there was a part of me that felt like that. And then there was another part of me that said, no, you know, what's wrong with being Mexican?
what's wrong with being poor? What's wrong with being who you are? And I really, like, had to look, dig deep. And I said, you know, like, I'm constantly told that there's something wrong with me. But I don't feel so wrong. I don't feel so bad. So I think, I don't know who that young woman was who had the courage to say, just because there are no roles for chunky Latinas or for women like me, it doesn't mean it's not possible. It just means that women need to start writing, that women need to start telling their stories. Because you know what? I don't know if I can say this on the radio, but women of every size, they have sex. Women of every size get married and they fall in love, you know? And real women, there are real women that are not being told. And part of it is because it's most of the stories come from a male point of view. And I guess they want women skinny enough that they can lift into the sunset and go have a happy ending. But for a lot of women like us, you know, the reality is that we are all different sizes. And especially if you're an ethnic woman, like if you're a very indigenous woman, you're not going to be, no matter what you do, you're not going to be 6 feet tall and you're not going to be skinny because God didn't create you that way. And what an insult to say that there's something wrong with God's design. And so there was a part of me that said, you know, why don't I take everything that is wrong with me and create a world where in this world, I'm just the right person. And what was so great was that even though I had to work in a sewing factory, I remember thinking, what an education. Because here are all these voluptuous, real women working in a sewing factory. And I got to work with my mother and my sister. And I got to see that women are powerful. Up until that point, I really believed that women were just dumb. You know, that we were like, we were inferior. I really internalized my sexism. And when I saw all these women working together and gossiping and talking and sewing and being a third world feminist and doing all these amazing things, it really was an education for me. And here I thought, wow, my friends are at Ivy League schools. And here I'm stuck in the barrio in a sewing factory. And there was a part of me that said, you know, but how wonderful that I got to see this. Because, you know, I'm not a victim. People would say, oh, look at these, you know, poor undocumented women having to suffer. And I said, yeah, you know, there's some degree of that. But the fact that we are here sewing and working and having such an incredible fun time and being women and really, like, I was like, wow, we are not victims. Because the incredible dignity that it takes for my mother, I mean, she's a superwoman. She would wake up at 6 a.m. to go make breakfast for my father, then sew for 12 hours, then go home, make dinner, then take care of the children. I was like, fuck you. Excuse me. I'm like very passionate here. I said, oh my God, like she's a superwoman. So this idea of us being victims and being powerless, forget it. And that was the inspiration behind it. There's so much more, but that really is what shifted things for me.
Yeah. So people, as I say, I'm sure a lot of people have seen it. That really was in large part your life.
Yes.
That the girl there, Anna, that's you. In a lot of ways,
I think I wasn't as smart as her, as Anna, because I think a lot of the characters that I write are women that I wish I could be, that I was as courageous and as intelligent, as, you know, assertive. So in many ways, Anna was the person that I was striving to be. And what was so exciting was that, you know, 11 years later after I wrote it, someone like America Ferrera, who was super intelligent, who was, you know, very assertive, you know, was raised by a single mom, was Anna.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour focus, Josefina Lopez. She's a playwright, screenwriter, author, performer. She wrote the highly acclaimed play and film Real Women Have Curves, and she has written many other plays and screenplays as well. A novel, which was published in 2009, the novel Hungry Woman in Paris, and she's here visiting the campus. She's visiting here, being hosted by the Department of Latino Studies. She spent a lot of time talking with students. She will be talking about her work and her life, her writing, and doing a book signing on the campus tomorrow afternoon. This will be at 5 o'clock at the University Y on 1001 South Wright in Champaign. So I'm sure anybody who would be interested in meeting her and hearing more from her, you should feel welcome to stop by. Questions, too, welcome here on the show as well. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Of course, writers, they put all of their experiences and their life into their work.
That's all you could do. You know, and no matter what you write, even if you write about Eskimos, it's still about you.
So at the same time, I think also you have, and in the play and in the movie, there's a lot of tension between mom and daughter here. And I think that one of the things, though, I know you've also said is that while there's a lot of you and your life in this movie, that the mom in the movie is not your mom.
No, she's not. My mother was not that mean. Most of my conflict was with my father, because my father grew up in Mexico and he didn't have an opportunity to get an education. He had mm-hmm. like a third or fourth grade education. So in his world, like, women just didn't go to college. Women were not educated, because he thought that it was a waste to educate women, because they would get married and then they'd be like, well, what'd you do with that education if you got married and had kids? Mm-hmm. Which I would respond and say, well, I think mothers have the most important job in the world. They just don't get paid for it. Mothers, you know, really, like, should have the most education, because they're the ones more responsible for shaping a human being, and they just don't get paid for it. And so, yeah, it was my father. But because in the play, there were only five women, we didn't want the movie to be about the men and how bad they were. Because the other thing, too, is that, you know, there's a lot of problems that men refuse to look at. And so women carry the burden of having to look at the conversation the men refuse to have. So with this movie, we said we wanted it to be about the women, because already, you know, it's hard enough to get men to go see women's films, because they go, oh, it's a chick flick, you know, and that's the way they dismiss it. If it makes no money, it's a chick flick. If it's a movie that makes a lot of money, then it's just a blockbuster, you know? It's really terrible. Yeah. And so so we said we can't make it about the men. It has to be about the women. And that way men will come see it, and men won't feel blamed, and then they'll be able to see a story. And the other reality is that it's unfortunate that the mothers become they perpetuate the machismo, that it's the mother who favors the sons and basically cuts the wings off of their daughters and says, well, this is the way it is. This is the way I was treated. This is the way it is. And, you know, you basically are here to my mother. I remember telling me that really, I mean, directly and indirectly, that my purpose in life was to basically be a servant to a man, that my father, my husband, and my son, and that's basically it. It was really sad. It was like, wow, I came here to be a servant on this planet. I didn't come here to be brilliant or to contribute to humanity. I came here to heat tortillas for somebody. It was a really sad future. And that's the time I was like, no, you know, well, then why would God give me all this creativity and intelligence unless I was meant to do more than mm-hmm. heat tortillas? Mm.
So now we were talking about how we were trying to figure out now how long it's been. It's been more than 20 years
yes.
since you wrote that. Yes. So now when you look at it now, how does it look to you?
It's wonderful. I mean, I can't believe that I had the courage to write it. I mean, I started writing when I was 5 years old, and my first play that I wrote was at 17. My first play that got produced at 18. So Real Women is my second play. And I just go, wow, who was that young woman who had the courage to do this? I'm really amazed, because I really felt like something else wrote it. Something else was working through me. Because when I wrote this, the characters were telling me what to write. Mm-hmm. It was some other divine force working through me, because I don't think I was that intelligent or clever or put together to write something like this. But I thank God that I did, because it basically created the dream. You know, it's like right now I'm working on the musical. We're trying to get to Broadway with the musical version of it. And I go, wow, like, this work is like taking me places, the places that I wanted to go to. And it's so wonderful that this was given to me, and that I could voice this, and that the consciousness was ready to hear it too. Yeah.
I think it's a pretty mature work for somebody who was 18
years
old.
Yes, I think I'm definitely an old soul. I think I think at 6 years old, I was not normal, because I was already very aware. You know, something happened to me that I think really changed things for me. When I was about 4 or 5 years old, I remember my mother and my brother were arguing about how the world was going to end. My brother had just learned that there was so much atomic power that we could destroy the world 7 times over. And he went home and told my mother. And my mother was like, that's not true. God's going to destroy the world. It says so in the Bible with fire. And they were like, no, it's going to be bombs, atomic. And I was like 5 years old going, oh, my God, the world's going to end. Like, you know, and back then it was like by year 2000, the world's going to end. Oh, my God. And I really was so shocked that I went to bed. I covered myself with the blankets. And I was so shocked, and I was like having these dreams, or not even dreams, but visions of the whole world being exploded, like, and me running around with a Jeep with Yogi Bear and all these cartoon characters looking for the last people on Earth. It was such a traumatic vision that I prayed to God, and I said, dear God, like, why would I come to this planet? Why would I come here if the world's going to end soon? Like, what is the point of being alive if we're all going to die? And then the point was, to make a difference, to make it matter that you were here at all. And that totally shifted the paradigm, the way I saw the world. And I thought, wow, we're all going to die someday. And I got real with death. And I said, you know, the point is to make a difference now and to contribute. And I think that's why that 18-year-old girl was already like
decades ahead.
Yeah. Today, it seems that there are, well, not seems, that there are certainly a lot more opportunities for women to write and perform. And it seems that television, particularly recently, has offered a lot more opportunities, particularly for women to do comedy. So we have comedies that are these created, written for women. So there are those parts there. I'm not sure how much, though, in terms of theme and image really has changed. How much has changed, do you think, and are there really more opportunities for women to write and perform?
There are more opportunities, but it's still very pathetic. I've been a screenwriter for over 20 years, and 20 years ago when I started, I thought, oh, wow, you know, like, it's just a matter of, like, you know, with Latinos, for instance, I thought, oh, it's just because people don't know about Latinos. Let me go educate. Let me go. And it's really pathetic that 20 years later, I'm going, we can only get one Latino show on the air, and it has to be an old white guy marrying a 20-year-old hot, sexy Latina. Wow, that's not a lot of progress. And then as far as women, you know, I've tried selling many shows where women are the leads. And if it's erotic in any way, or I mean, like, I tried selling a show, and I can't even say it, I think, out loud because I'm not supposed to contractually. But it's a show that you would think, oh, my God, this movie is one of the most famous movies, one of the most erotic movies ever made. You could get it made in cable, and we could not sell it. And part of that was, like, the idea of a woman being assertive about her sexuality. And you would think, even with Sex and the City, that, wow. And it's like, no, you can't get a movie like this made. A TV show. And we have not been able to sell it. And we're like, we're shocked that in 2012, you can't have a woman be sexually assertive. And also look at sexual wounds, you know. And how we're, so, no, I don't think there's a lot of progress. I think we're about 20 years behind. And as far as Latino shows, you know, you cannot touch immigration. You cannot in any way touch immigration. No one will touch that show. No one will make that show. And trying to write about immigrants, I didn't realize that by trying to write about Latino immigrants that you take a vow of poverty, because nobody will, like, pay. No, it's just no one wants to hear it. It's just too controversial. And a lot of what determines what gets on TV is it going to be controversial? Are advertisers going to pull away? Are people going to protest? Then they stay safe. And so, we're 20 years behind.
Right. Really, even after all the things we hear about, particularly in cable, being a place where you can do cutting edge drama, not even,
you know,
there?
I guess some people would call it progress. I feel like, wow, these things that I'm seeing on television, I'm like, oh my God, you know, like maybe I was that woman about 15 years ago. I think women, I mean, also if you look at the numbers, like how many writers, how many women writers, like how few we are. And part of it is not because, like, women are not talented like men. It's because there is a system that keeps women out. And some people say no. I mean, people say no, it's just that these men just work harder. I'm like, no, we work three times as hard as you, but we can't get in the door. Or maybe I got my foot in the door, thank God, but I still keep getting it slammed. And I'm like, no. And maybe because I carry the double burden of being a Latina woman, that I just don't see the progress at all.
Mm. Mm. The play Real Women Have Curves is a comedy. The movie has a sort of dramatic element, but I think that you still describe it as being a comedy drama or a dramatic comedy or something like that. Would it be your impulse to write comic stuff?
I mean, you know what? I'm very funny. And my husband tells me, you know, when you don't try to be funny, you're really funny. And I go, oh, really? I said, yeah, it's when you try it, you're not funny. I'm like, oh, okay, great. And then here's the thing is that I get that. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why my work is very funny. But one of them is if I start writing dramas about what's really going on, some people don't want to hear dramas. It's like, it's hard. You know, I think the reason this work succeeded is because it's a very funny show about something very interesting, dramatic, controversial, mm-hmm. but in a way that people can swallow the sweet pill. And had I written a drama, I don't think it would have been as successful or as commercial. Not that I care about that. But yeah, you know, it's like the other reason is that no matter how oppressed somebody is, if they can keep their sense of humor, they will survive. And sense of humor is part of having dignity. It's when you're like, all right, I've got everything going against me. But you know what? Da-da-da. You see the bright side, even if it's a tiny little piece. And that, I think, is a point of view about having dignity, about not seeing yourself as a victim. Even a little ant thing. All right, you know, everything's going against me. But you know what? I've got, I don't know, you know, it's like a point of view where you refuse to be defeated, even though all the odds are against you. And that's funny. That's an extreme, you know, like anytime you get to extremes, that's funny. And so so I think that's also why. But yeah, no, I mean, I can't help but be funny in my work because, you know, because I write about very painful things. And what I get is that no matter when it gets so painful, I automatically will bring in the comedic relief. I automatically will find the funny because anytime something is so painful, it's an extreme, so it's funny.
You were in the movie, right?
I had a cameo, yes.
Would you like to have, even at this point where you're really channeling your creative impulses through writing, would you like to have more opportunities to act?
I've had many people. It's funny. I've been so many people want to cast me as a madam or, you know, working in a brothel, and because I'm so sexually assertive and I'm so, you know, assertive as a woman, that they're like, oh my god, you know, like only, and I'm like, okay, great. I go, you know, how about a judge? All right, I'd like to play a judge. No, I think I am going to pursue my acting, and part of it is like, you know, at a certain age for Latinas, you there's only like you can only play the maid or the hot señorita. Right now, those are the only roles. And unless you have a name, you know, like I auditioned for Dolores Huerta for the Cesar Chavez movie that's going to get made by Diego Luna. And I thought, you know what? I kind of look like, you know, Dolores Huerta when she's a little younger. And, you know, I'm like, I could play Dolores Huerta. And, of course, you know, they wanted someone with a name. And so I thought, yes, I do. I'm at the point now in my age, I'm 43, where I go, yeah, you know, now I can play women with substance. And if those roles don't exist, then I'm happy to produce films where I get to play women of substance. And I don't get to have to go, oh, I'm going to have to play hot señorita to get cast, you know?
Our guest in this hour of focus is Josefina Lopez. She's a playwright, screenwriter, author, performer. She's visiting the campus, talking about her work. And we will talk with her some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Carole King wrote songs for others before writing them for herself and becoming a performer.
Did I have my own persona in mind? Uh-uh. It just evolved.
On the next Fresh Air, Carole King. She has a new memoir and a new album of her legendary demos. Join us. Say and do.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support comes from Subaru of Champaign County, located on Route 45 in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieved zero landfill status with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings, 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. Tomorrow, you'll be hearing a conversation that I'm actually going to have today. We're recording this, so we won't be taking calls. But you will hear a conversation that I'll be having with Andrea Seabrook. She is the congressional correspondent for National Public Radio. She's visiting here in Champaign-Urbana, will be with us. And so we'll talk with her about some of her experiences as a journalist and what it's like to cover Congress. And then in the second hour tomorrow, we'll talk about a recent change in Illinois law that will make it possible, with some restrictions, to bring cameras into the courtrooms here in the state of Illinois. And we'll have two guests, and each of them have a different sort of take on this. Steve Beckett, who has had a long career as an attorney here in Champaign-Urbana, and now he teaches at the U of I Law School. And then Nancy Martyr will also join us. She's professor of law at the University of Chicago, I think. And each of them has some concerns. And basically, Steve says he thinks it's a good idea. And Nancy Martyr says she's not quite so sure. So you can hear what both of them have to say. And we'll talk about that tomorrow. You can look at the schedule, find out what we are doing on the program by going to our website. That's WILL.illinois.edu. That way you can also listen to past programs. We have a big web archive there of past interviews. In this hour of the show, we're talking with Josefina Lopez. She's a playwright and a screenwriter. People probably will know her best for her play that was made into a film, Real Women Have Curves. She's written a lot of other screenplays and play stage plays. She's done some work as an actor and also has written a novel that has recently come out, was published in 2009. Hungry Woman in Paris is the title of the novel. She's visiting the campus, the Department of Latino Studies sponsoring her. And I want to mention again that if you'd like to meet her and hear more from her, she'll be doing a talk about her work and a book signing at the University YMCA, 1001 South Wright in Champaign tomorrow. 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And questions here. People want to call in, you can do that. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. So you were just, we had just had the short break and you launched into a story about something that you were talking about or were trying to develop as a movie.
Oh.
And you just said that you just made reference to the bride's...
Oh, yeah, no, you talk about, like, is there progress? And I go... You know, Hangover did really well, and then The Bridesmaids did really well. And so a director and I did a movie called, we wrote a screenplay called Foursome, and it's about four women who have a bachelorette party in New Orleans. And we can't get them made, and part of it is, like, you know, you can't have women down and dirty like men. It's just not allowed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you think, oh, my God, you know, men can do that. Let's do it. And no, nobody wants to see that script. And they're like, no. It's just that people get really protective about women's sexuality because I guess it's very threatening.
Well, somehow, I think a lot of people thought that Bridesmaids, that had opened up some kind of door. And because it was
yeah, I mean, this
doing, showing women that, you know,
this is
you
probably the first year where, like, you actually see a lot of women being leads in shows. So it does look like progress, right? But again, you know, it's white women, and you just go, okay, you know. And I mean, I love Tina Fey, and I think she's like my role model. But I go, yeah, you know, she has the opportunities that I as a Latina, you're basically no, you can't do that, and it's really sad. Anyway.
Well, I want to have you talk a little bit about Hungry Woman in Paris. Now, here, moving, I would imagine that moving from doing screenplays and stage plays, from that to a novel, I would think that might be kind of a big jump.
No, actually, writing novels is easier. They're how difficult. I mean, I'm not going to, like, dismiss it and say, like, no. Screenwriters will tell you that making the transition is actually easier because screenplays, you have to tell a story in 20,000 words. Whereas a novel, you can take 100,000, 200,000, you know, I mean, 100,000 words, and you're like, you could describe everything, you know, you could take your time, you could develop this, you can go into the character's head, and you can, like, go flashback, you know. In a novel, there's a lot of things you can't do. And that's how come everybody goes, oh, the book was so much better. And it's like, well, yeah, because it's pretty impossible to adapt a novel where you had access to every point, everything. In a screenplay, you can't. So it was actually a lot of fun. And, you know, about every 2, 3, 4 years, I get sick of Hollywood and I go away. And because, you know, there's after so much rejection, you go, you know what? Let me go figure something out. Let me try something. Let me go take care of my spirit and my heart. Let me go create another work of art that's validating. That's also why I do theater and why I paint and I'm a poet and I do other things. Because if you just work in Hollywood, you could easily become an addict. You could be an alcoholic because, it's, you know, if you're in it for the money, And you're trying to do something, forget it. You know, it's hard. So writing this novel, I actually got to go to Paris. I went there with my husband. My husband's French-American. And we lived there, and I went to go have the writer's fantasy. And then when I was there, I was also having my second child. And I got really bored. And then I said, oh, my God, let me go to cooking school. You know, the fantasy of so many people is to go to Cordon Bleu and go to cooking school. And it really is a way of, like, taking care of your soul. A lot of people go there who've done jobs that they've hated. They made a lot of money, and they're like, oh, my God, let me take, like, 6 months to just take care of me because my soul got beaten. And you know, with the food, with Paris. So I wanted to write a book about going to cooking school because all my life I was made fun of by my mother and my sisters because I couldn't cook. It was like, okay, well, maybe you got all these degrees, but, you know, you can't. And I'm like, oh, my God, you know, like, I have all these accomplishments, but I can't cook. And so I said, you know what, let me go to Cordon Bleu, like, get my little, I'm a chef now, you know, like, shut up, I can cook, okay? I just don't cook because I'm busy trying to do so many other things. And I wanted to take Latina women to Paris. And I also, I mean, and it's funny because, like, I didn't realize that Eat, Pray, Love was just coming out when I was, like, you know, having this idea of, like, oh, women who really treats men like food, you know, where they're men like food and then also just like dessert because they're not the main meal of her life. When a woman who realizes, you know what, my life isn't about getting married and being, you know, having the fairy tale. My life is about
what am I here to do, and what am I? How can I contribute to society? And it's the stories about a journalist who tries to write stories about all the soldiers that are dying in Iraq, the very first ones, and a lot of them were all Latino. A lot of them, you know, like the first ones to die were all Latino, really poor, uneducated Latinos who were basically had no other options but to go and fight in war, or other Latinos who were trying to get green cards by joining, you know, the army. And nobody would let her do those stories. And so she kept having fights with editors until she realized, oh, my God, it's the media censored. There's no freedom of speech. We can't tell the truth about what's really going on. And just like me, you know, my husband and I were against the war. And we left this country because we were against the war. And we all knew, I mean, it was a sham. And it's like, come on, wake up. And no, and we went to so many protests that we said, no, we can't. We object to what's going on. We went to France. And then I decided to write the novel.
Yeah. So that's it. And indeed, the story is about this woman who goes.
Well, the reason she goes,
to cooking school.
I mean, she doesn't have the same reason. Her reason is because if you go to cooking school, you can get a visa for 9 months to a year and you can stay in France, because otherwise you can only stay there for 3 months. And so she uses it as an excuse. And the other thing is she broke off an engagement, and her whole family thinks she's crazy because the guy's a doctor and he's wonderful, and they just think she's nuts and she's severely, like, you know, should be locked up or whatever. And so she does it to stay away from her family, from her domineering mother. And so she goes to cooking school, and eventually she has to go. She gives herself a year to postpone her life, to just be on hold, and then have to go confront her life.
So what was your experience in cooking school like?
Well, it's really interesting because I'm in cooking school again in California. I'm opening a restaurant called Hungry Woman in Paris. And so I'm brushing up on my techniques. And it's really interesting because Cordon Bleu, it's like all male chefs. And some of them were nicer than the typical French chef, but a lot of them were like, oh, you know. And it was very stressful and painful. And it was, you know, you realize how sexist it was. That really, like, the women were treated like, oh, you're just here to cook better dinners for your husbands. But the men, okay, the men are the ones we're going to take seriously. It was that delineated. And it's sad because in France, there's only like one woman who has a restaurant with one star, and she inherited it from her grandfather. But basically, like, women, it's like, it is sexist, and it's pretty, like, and women, you know, you basically have to seduce people to get ahead, and that's pretty acceptable in French culture. It's like, and it's funny, like, anyway, I'm going off on tangents here. But now that I'm in cooking school in California and L.A., it's like all the chefs are women, and they all open cooking schools because I guess got sick of being, you know, harassed in the kitchen. And so it's such a different experience, you know, to... Anyway, that's probably another novel. Yeah. but it was one of the things I realized is that, you know, cooking makes me feel alive. But one of the other things, the reasons I did it is because, you know, growing up as an immigrant with seven siblings, you're always thinking about food because you don't know if there's going to be food. You know, it was always about survival. And so I thought, you know, I want to go have a different relationship with food, where food is something that you celebrate, that you take your time instead of this stressful, like, oh my God, you know, I have to stuff myself. And I think that also has a lot to do with the issues that I've had with food and my weight, is because it was always about, like, even though, like, you know, I'm a very successful, wealthy person now, I've had to stop and go, hey, no one's going to take this food away from you. You know, you don't have a brother who's going to, like, beat you to it. You know, you don't have to, like,
yeah, it's this theme, hunger, literal and metaphorical, seems to be real important.
Yes,
for
the book is all about the kinds of hungers that, even sexual hunger, the fact that women are not allowed, like men, you know, they're hungry, they go get sex. Whereas it's like, oh my God, I feel bad, you know, oh, do I really, like, I have to fall in love in order to get sex, you know, women have to lie to themselves about being in love in order to, they can't just say, you know, I'm horny, I'm going to go get some, you know? Can I just, like, serve myself some, you know? Like, no. Like, all these stories that you... And especially as Latinas. It's like this whole Catholic guilt BS. And that's why I thought, you know, why can't a woman own her hungers and go feed herself and nurture her soul, her spirit, her body?
Yeah. We're jumping around, but I'm just thinking it's really... I'm really interested in the fact that so many people are attracted to the idea of cooking for a living. And it's really hard work. Restaurant kitchens are
very
hot.
Stressful.
It's very stressful. It's very competitive.
Chefs have the
There's
highest,
a lot of, like, machismo,
like,
going on.
Yeah, yeah.
You get cut. You get burned. It's long hours. It's really hard. And I don't know. I'm not exactly sure why. I mean, I like to be in the kitchen. I'm just an average home cook. I don't know that I would want to be doing the Olympics of cooking, like, you know,
it's
see
the biggest
on
adrenaline
television.
Rush It's a huge, like, yeah. Me with ADD, I was like, oh my God, like, what? It's like being in war, you know, and like people shooting at you. It's like that. Yeah. The closest you get to war in the kitchen, being in the kitchen, when, you know, people want, like, the food right away. I don't definitely don't want to be in the kitchen. It's a fun thing. But I think the smells, the touching, the five senses are completely wide open. And you feel alive. And I think, and it's funny how there's an explosion of like people wanting, people like wanting to open restaurants, all these networks, cooking. And I think it's because people have long neglected themselves, and cooking is the way you kind of restore order. You become present. You take care of a part of you that yearns to be nurtured.
Yeah. And it's also a performance.
Yes.
And it's definitely, it's a performance. So maybe it's a different kind of performance, but I think that maybe also appeals to people. And it's in a kitchen, if it's going to work, it's got to be a team, but it's also, there's a lot of solo.
It's very erotic because it's like, it's funny because like in my book, I talk about how the pastry chefs, it was like mostly women studying pastry at Cordon Bleu, and it was like a very sexy French chef, and he'd be like, oh, massage the dough. And he was like, look, it's like a breast. You caress it and you move it this way. And like, and the women are all going, oh, like the men in there are like, oh, like, but the women are like, wow, look at the way he touches that dough and like squeezes. It's just very erotic.
I'm sorry. I'm just, I don't know quite what to say right at this moment. Tell me what things that you would like to do. Are there some things that you would like to do that you haven't been able to do?
Well, acting, I guess. I think that's probably my next thing. But I'm actually working on producing my first film. I wrote a play called Detained in the Desert. As soon as the SB 1070 law was proposed, I wrote a play in protest, and we performed this play. It's very successful. It's having several productions, and I just think, wow, it should be a movie. And so I'm working on making my first film because it's too controversial. Hollywood will not touch it, so I think I have to make it myself. So I would say that I want to start making films because the kinds of roles that I want to play, I don't think anyone's going to cast me. I don't think so.
So you will be acting in this and directing, or
this
one?
I'll probably have a cameo in this one because I'm learning to produce. Mm-hmm. I produce theater, but I still haven't produced films. But no, eventually, I think I'm going to say, you know what? I'm going to get to play all the women that I know that I'm capable of playing. That I'm not going to get a chance by any Hollywood movie like studio to play. You know.
So now tell me about what's involved in trying to make a musical version of Real Women Have Curves.
Well, you know, someone said that it takes at least $8 to $10 million to get to Broadway. So the process is very long because you have to be perfect. You have to be ready to go because you can't take any chances once you open that there's something missing, because by then it costs too much to make a mistake. So I'm working with a producer. We're working on the book. And what's so great is that because there is a play and there is a movie and time has passed, that I could take the play and the movie, the best elements, and then, you know, the immigration is such a hot topic and so much has changed that we can incorporate a lot of what's going on right now. Mm-hmm. So it's incorporating, you know, the play, the movie, and the topics right now. And then also finding a way that it has to be universal, that people, you know, because it costs about $130 to get a ticket. I'm thinking, you know, it has to be somewhat controversial, but it can't be too much because, you know, people go there to get entertained. And so a lot of it has to be about, like, where are the opportunities where there's just so much emotion, where there's a song? Where are the dance numbers? You know, how can we make it a spectacle? Mm-hmm. Instead of five women, can we add more character so that there's a moment where there's going to be, like, the big Broadway moment where everybody goes, oh, my God, look at the dance. You know, like the light.
Dancing on the sewing machines.
Yeah, there has to be spectacle because people then feel like, okay, I paid $138, whatever. And then they go, oh, my God, I had a night in the, you know. So those are the challenges of, like, okay, and then how do we keep the story universal and simple? So it's a huge challenge. So right now, you know, I've done a couple of drafts on the book, but now we're bringing in a lyricist and a composer, and then they're taking the moments where we go, okay, here's a song, here's a moment for a song, and then so it's a long process, and then you have to workshop it with actors, and then, you know, there's limitations because you can't, like, do too many workshops because then you have to commit to the actors, because then it's not fair for them to help you develop it and then not get to go to Broadway. So it's a long, long process.
Yeah, that's I'm sure, as you say, it's so difficult because it's so expensive. It takes such a long time, and then, as you say, audiences are very, in part because it's so expensive. Audiences are very, you know, really don't know what's going to appeal to them.
And then the other challenge is, how do we make this sound like it's Latino, but it has to be a Broadway musical, because there's Broadway snobs are like, oh my God, this isn't a Broadway musical. Because a lot of people from the pop world have tried to do musicals, and they try to break the mold, and then people go, no, you didn't follow the mold, nobody will come. You know, it's like, so that's the challenge.
So on top of all of this, you're a mom.
Yes.
You have two
children? Boys. I have two boys, a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old.
Yeah. How do you manage to balance all, you know, to do the old work, life?
I have an extraordinary
balance.
Husband. I really give credit to him because, and I knew that I had to have an extraordinary man. And my parents didn't believe that such men existed, because they're like, oh, if you don't know how to cook and clean, what Mexican man's going to want to marry you? And I said, okay, I don't think I'm going to end up with a Mexican man as much as I want to. And this extraordinary man, basically, you know, we've had struggles. And part of it is he had to realize that he had to be an extraordinary human being to be with someone as crazy as me. And he basically is incredible. And we've had to really say, okay, we can't follow gender roles, because we just have to be the best parents for these kids. And you know, my husband's also an activist. When I met him, he was working with homeless people doing theater. And he's a brave person. And so we kind of have to have discussions where we go, you know what? It's not about a structure. It's about the fact that all these things are going to get done. And also, you know, our children need to see that, you know, like, I mean, I feel a lot of guilt. I'll be honest with you. I there was one time where I got all these awards and I had to go to an award show like every week, pretty much. And my kids were bored. They're like, you're going to go get another award? I go, honey, I'm speaking out for like Mexicans undocumented. They're like, ah, that's stupid. You know, like they're like, that's so boring. Why can't you just stay home and be with me and watch a movie? And I was like, because I need to stand up for my community. And they're like, they don't get it. And then. So it's I would say that of everything, that's the one place that's the most difficult, that I'm still learning how to negotiate that. And I probably will probably write a book about this, because, and then the other thing is, like, both my kids have ADD. So my kids are hyperactive and they're very intuitive, and they're it's like, oh my God, like, but think, you know, I think it'd be more difficult to have girls. So at least I thank God that, like, these kids are boys, and they're pretty unbreakable, and they're crazy and you know. It's a lot of work.
So do they say to you, oh, Mom, you should write, tell you what it is you should be writing about? They say, so you should write this.
No, but it's exciting that, like, it's so wonderful. Like, when I was 8 years old, I wrote my first short story. And here's my son at 9 telling me his short stories. And I you know, I have an iPad, too, and I gave my old iPad to my son. And my son's, like, he really wants to learn how to spell, because he really, like, is, like, he wants to tell stories. And so he's so motivated to write stories. And then my other son is drawing. He's an artist, and he tells stories with cartoons. And I'm like, oh my God, my kids are storytellers. I'm so excited, you know.
Yeah. So I'm sure that you have spent a lot of time talking with young people who want to be actors, writers, you know, performers. And so they're dealing with all of the challenges of trying to figure out who they are and what they want to do and can they do it. And what sort of things do you try to tell them?
One of the things that I've had to do is that, you know, if you knew all the rejections, like all the failures that I've had, you'd be like, oh my God, like, you know, there's like 20 to 1, okay? And if you look at everything, you think, oh my God, a loser, you know? And it's like, no, because you only see the great things, you know, that where I've succeeded. And here's the thing is that after 20 years, most people would give up or be addicts or alcoholics, because the kind of rejection that I've gotten. And one of the things that I realized is that I have to declare myself the winner, that I've already won, because the fact that I won't give up, that it may take 40 years for finally, like, or it may never happen in my lifetime, that the kind of world, the kind of images, the kind of movies and things that I want may never happen in my lifetime, that I've already declared myself the winner, that I'm not going to measure myself by anybody's standard about what success is. And so that's what, and you know, the other thing too is that, like, no one would produce my plays. After, you know, Real Women, I thought, oh my God, and then no one would produce my plays. So I had to learn to produce theater, and now I have my own theater and cultural center. And no one right now is producing my movies. No one will produce my movies. And so I'm like, okay, well, then I'm going to have to become a film producer. And I've had to expand And I realize that a lot of the problems that we have is that we see ourselves as too small. So when people say, oh, I've got this, or this can't happen, then I go, well, you have to expand. You're going to have to learn more skills. You're going to have to see yourself as more powerful than you think you are in order to make that dream happen. And what's so amazing is that whatever dream you have, your unconscious mind knows that you can get it. It already knows how. But the conscious mind, which is like way behind, doesn't know how. So if whatever dream you have, you already know how to do it. But slowly, you'll have to go on a journey so that the conscious mind will allow you to have it.
Yeah. It's been so good to talk with you. I so much appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Oh, thank you.
And I do want to mention again for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana that Josefina Lopez, will be giving a talk, a book signing, talking about her work at the University YMCA this afternoon at, no, sorry, tomorrow, Thursday, right, tomorrow at 5, University Y, 1001 South Wright in Champaign. Anybody who is interested should stop by. And if you haven't seen Real Women Have Curves, go out and find the DVD and watch the movie. Thanks very much.
Thank
for being
you
here.
So Thank much. You. This is wonderful.